John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
Ben Elton, one of my guests, the ventriloquist David Strassman, the other one, joining us between now and noon, and my co-host, comedian, writer, actor Felicity Ward.
Good morning, John Fain. How are you?
What are we going to talk about?
Do you know what I wanted to ask you? Have you ever been on a cruise?
No.
I'm going on a cruise. Not for a holiday. I'm going on there to work, and I don't know what's better or worse.
Where are you going?
Nowhere. So my idea of purgatory is being trapped on a boat with people that want to be on a boat going nowhere. That's what we do, and we go out for 3 days. You don't go anywhere. We just sail. Not sail, because there's no sail.
But motor.
We motor.
From where to where?
We start at Sydney, we finish at Sydney.
Does it go in for the 3 days?
I don't know, down the south coast? It doesn't
just
stop
goes out
anywhere.
To sea.
It just goes out to sea.
Oh, hang on. I know why.
Are they going to kill me?
No, I know why.
Why?
Has it got a casino on board?
Don't they all? I don't know.
That's why. Because then they go out of the territorial jurisdiction of New South Wales and there are no rules.
Oh, my goodness.
They can go to
goodness.
Sea, they can do what they like.
And it's like one giant casino where there's no windows and you can't tell what time of day it is.
And they can serve alcohol 24/7 and they can do anything and they do sometimes too.
Amazing.
I hope they're paying you a lot of money.
I'm not willing to discuss that on
How many shows do you have to do in 3 days?
I only do 2 half-an-hour spots and then I do a 7-minute spot, but the 7-minute spot has to be completely clean.
7 minutes?
Yes.
But
I don't have a lot of material that doesn't have swearing in it. So I have to adjust some of that.
And for that, they pay you money and give you 3 days of accommodation, food and cruise.
Yeah.
Do you get a cabin that's got a little window and things?
I don't know.
Or do you get a hammock in the boiler room?
Yeah, that's it. They just when the outdoor shuffleboard is finished, they throw a pillow down and a blanket. That's
and
what
then they
do.
Bring you leftovers from other people's plates.
Yeah,
and
I'll
say,
still
here,
eat that.
Eat these scraps.
I'm not too proud, John. I'm not too proud.
So how did this come about?
I don't know. It's something that some comedians have done before, and I got asked if I wanted to do it. I was like, you know what? At absolute worst, it's going to be a story.
Make a show out of it.
Exactly. At the best, it could be a really great, fun experience. I don't know what they have on there. I have all these fantasies because people have told me there's like cruises with cinemas and outdoor volleyball. And straight away I go, you're going to hit the ball over the edge into the water. But
you're going to meet a lonely billionaire.
I love the word. I love lonely as well.
Lonely octogenarian billionaire who's a few months from a last gasp.
Who do you think I am?
Who you can absolutely immediately fall magically and passionately in love with and then fleece him for every cent that he's got.
That is a mentality that I have never – I'm not trying to be noble here. I have no interest or understanding of people that marry just for money. I have absolutely – there is no part of my being that goes, you know what, I get it.
No, I do get it. It's done for love.
It
just happens to be a billionaire who's twice your age and is about to cark it.
Yeah, look, and I'm sure that some people that happens, they do fall in love and good on them. But people who are like comfortable with saying I married for money, I don't know how to process that.
Are there people who do that?
Yeah.
No, they never admit it.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
Yeah, they do.
No, they always say it was love.
Yeah.
Charisma. Oh, I just completely was bewitched and fell under the spell of such an exciting man who just sadly only had a few months left on this life.
And do you like my dress made of saffron?
Yes.
That kind of stuff.
And my first class lifestyle based on the fortune that I managed to squeeze out of him along with his last gasp.
I like that you're saying his and that it doesn't happen the other way, John.
Well, I'm not aware of it, does it?
I'm sure it does.
Oh, no, it doesn't.
It doesn't? Come on. It doesn't exist? You're saying this is primarily a woman's
15 issue? 15 years ago, we were in Venice on holidays.
Playing.
And we were sitting in a restaurant having some dinner. And there was this woman at the table, I don't know, one or two along. Now, how do I describe her? She looked a bit like Cruella de Vil from 101 Dalmatians. So, but not nearly as glamorous, but just evil. She was... She was very loud with her American accent and she had a much, much younger companion, toy boy kind of slave with her who she was bossing around something shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole restaurant had to hear her when at one point, and she was, you know, she had pink and purple hair and she had rings on every finger and really gaudy and loud and flashy and everything. And at once, and she was ancient, like really ancient. And the slave would have been in his 20s. So he was just ridiculously underage. And at one stage, she said to him as she pushed away a plate of dessert, she said, "I don't want ice. I don't want gelati. I want ice cream, real ice cream. Get me real ice cream." And she said it in such such volume and such a repulsive kind of snarl in her voice. And the whole restaurant just stopped and stared. And this poor young man, who was her kind of chaperone or whatever, went bright pink and had to get up and take the gelati away and
now
get real ice cream.
Why is he a poor young man? If he's in his 20s, he's making a decision to be there.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Oh, this poor victim. Oh, he's being dragged around by this woman. He can say no. He can leave.
Yeah. He's probably on some terrific retainer.
This is such a gross topic. How did we get here? How did
you
we
started
get...
it.
You said I was going to meet a millionaire octogenarian on my cruise.
Well, that's what cruises... This is my prejudice.
I'm there to work.
Right, okay.
I'm there to tell the jokes.
So it's just another gig.
It's just another gig. But it could be fun.
I don't know who goes on cruises. It's a whole world that's a complete mystery to me.
Yeah, I'm about to find out. I was going to say, I will never know. That's not true. I will find out very soon.
Wow. So when's that?
That's next week. I'm going to Tasmania this week. Going down to Tassie, doing some gigs down there. What is that furrowed
ground
around for? Yeah, I know. I'm very rarely in Melbourne. You're lucky to have me.
I reckon we are too. So we just grab you when we get the chance.
That's right.
And off on the cruise, shuffleboard. That's what they do.
Yeah, shuffleboard.
Shuffleboard.
Yep. Yeah. I'm going to have to learn how to play that and bridge. I assume there's a lot of bridge that happens on cruises. I don't know. I have these not fantasies, but I imagine there's a lot of septuagenarians and octogenarians sitting around at tables at 3 o'clock in the morning playing bridge. Am I correct?
I don't know. I should explore and find out.
Mm. Well, I'll report back.
Is it like a, you know, 6-star thing?
I have no idea. Okay. I really should know. I only found out that we weren't going anywhere because people kept asking me where we're going.
Yeah, you'd go to, you know, Samoa or...
Yeah, that would be nice.
Vanuatu or somewhere
a little
exotic.
Island tour would be lovely.
Yeah.
I love that. Not happening. No. Staying on a boat, days bound.
It's just your first one, Felicity.
It's my first one,
There may well be more.
I'm doing it with Sammy J and Cal Wilson, so it will be a lot of fun.
Ah, there you are. I want a book on this cruise.
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm interested.
Or at least a video. We'll upload something.
Felicity Ward, my co-host, comedian and actor, a cruise ship where old comedians go to die, says Helen in St Kilda. You should only marry for lots of money.
There you go. There it is.
A few of the texts that have come in while I've been having that chat with Felicity Ward, my co-host. Our first guest in a moment, Ben Elton, writer, comedian, and I might say also now, do we say historian? He draws on his own family's history to write a new novel about two boys who grow up and find themselves, despite being brothers, fighting on opposite sides in World War II. Yes, that draws on Ben Elton's personal family history. He's our first guest, the ventriloquist David Strassman, joining us as our next guest, and that's the conversation hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Ben Elton, writer and comedian, and now also, do I say, historian, has written a novel about two brothers who end up fighting on opposite sides in World War II. It draws loosely on his own family history, which in a postword to the book he tells us a little bit about. Ben Elton, welcome back to the conversation now.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me back. There's very few programs like this remaining, and it's a joy to be on it.
We're dinosaurs. Tell me about your family and how, in fact, the Ehrenbergs became Elton.
Well, they didn't all. As you said, this is absolutely a fiction, but it's inspired by a very interesting circumstance from my own family history. My father is a Hitler refugee, a German Jew who was lucky enough to escape Nazi Germany. The book is called Two Brothers. It's dedicated to two cousins, my uncles Heinz and Jeffrey, one of whom served in the Wehrmacht and the other in the British Army. And the reason for this is because Heinz was adopted. he was not Jewish. The family weren't Jewish religiously. I consider Judaism a religion, but clearly Hitler believed it was a race, and so they were in extreme danger. Heinz was not Jewish as an adopted child, and when some of my family were able to get out, he remained. He was studying agriculture. He wanted to finish his studies and indeed farm the farm his father had gifted him as he left, because obviously the Germans didn't allow any Jews to leave with any money. But of course, the war interrupted and he was drafted into the Wehrmacht. And so I had two uncles, one on either side, and got to know Heinz again after the war when I knew him in the 60s. The reason that my name is Elton and not Ehrenberg is simply that as happens to the character in the book, when Geoffrey joined the British Army, my father's brother joined the British Army, he was virtually instructed to anglicise his name. He was strongly advised, he said, in case of capture, to not have a German Jewish name. And he was told literally to come back the next day with an English name. Yeah, which so he is, went back to the barracks. And
exactly what my mother's cousin, known now as Roberts,
right,
exactly the same thing too. And he was fiercely and patriotically English, although born in Germany.
Well, my uncle became very patriotically British. I'm very well aware that a great and civilized nation gave safety and a new life
to
asylum seekers. Yeah. My father was an asylum seeker, a refugee from terror and torture. Geoffrey, particularly, almost a conservative Englishman, and very much so. But as I say, my father joined him and anglicised his name, but my grandparents remained Ehrenbergs until their death in London in the 1970s.
They weren't Chelsea supporters, were
they? No, they were very sort of erudite individuals. They were into books, not sport.
And how long have you been sort of contemplating about writing about this? How long have you been sitting on it, and why is it the right time now?
I don't know if you ever know whether it's the right or the wrong time. I write when I feel like writing. All art is a form of self-expression. It's an improvisation, and I guess you go when the muse, when the thought strikes you. This, unlike all my other novels, is an idea that has been gestating. There's no doubt about that. Normally, for me, it's cause and effect. I'm a sort of fairly restless writer. I have an idea, it excites me, and I get on with it. So the idea and the execution follow pretty much one after the other. This, because I've always known about this family history and this very interesting, fascinating idea that a family could be so arbitrarily and so brutally divided that overnight, by act of law, the people around the same tea table become either valuable human beings or subhuman vermin and enemies of the state overnight. Always fascinated me as somebody, I read history a great deal, it's my passion. So I've always wanted to write it. Now seemed right. Maybe I needed to have my own family. It was always going to be a family story about loyalties and both family and love. It's a love story. I guess you need to have some maturity to write properly about love. I don't know.
Day you'll get to do it.
Someday I'll get to do it, yes. He's hard, isn't he? Well, I could do it out in at the ABC.
In.
I tell you what, if you want to take me on, mate, I shall leave you a few put-downs, but I expect I'll get beaked out very
quickly.
He
is rolling up the cuffs of his sleeves.
I can't beat live to air as we go. No. It'll be a fair competition and a tough one. Hey, but the other thing you tell us, and sorry, Felicity, to interrupt the flow, but it's just, this is the crucial thing. The protagonists in the book and in real life, how close do they come to actually exchanging shots?
Well,
personally, collectively.
In my personal history, and I stress again, this is entirely fictitious. I'm not interested in writing a biography of my family. I'm not interested in writing the history of this period, only in as much as it empowers a fiction, a love story, a family saga. But certainly it was interesting for us. After the war, both Geoffrey and Heinz survived, amazingly, 6 years in the Wehrmacht, but he actually was only 2 years in the front line and then became a driver, which is what saved him, a staff driver. And we got to know Heinz again. He was a loved cousin. And as I say, I visited that very farm that was bought for him in the Nazi time on my holidays as a little boy in the 60s. And it was uncovered between Geoffrey and Heinz that they'd both served in Italy in action. And it's possible that they might, who knows how close they might have got. They had no idea. And I play with that idea slightly in the novel.
Oh, I can't remember what I was going to say. That was so interesting. At the end of it all, they were still cousins and friends, and continued. That that's not the exact story of the book, but
nonetheless, I think the example of my family history is what should I need reminding of the banality of racism, the madness of such arbitrary human divisions that we suddenly become passionate, murderously passionate. And clearly my family is a great example of the nonsense of such a thing here. We have two people forced to fight in opposite armies, basically, then coming together again after the war. And Geoffrey was at... Heinz was at my uncle's Geoffrey's funeral. He died in 1994, and the last time I saw Heinz was then. But he met my wife, and I find it very moving to think that Uncle Heinz, you know, adopted into a Jewish family in the 1920s, served in Hitler's armies in 1994, meets my Australian wife. You know, this is a connection of history and family that I find very moving, and that you know, love and a degree of heroism allowed that to happen because they were people who survived.
There's another strand through the book, and it's a huge book, so it encompasses an enormous span from the 1920s through to much more recent events, including the collapse of the Berlin Wall.
Absolutely, it takes it through to that, yes.
And there's another theme, which is people doing whatever it takes to survive where they are at that time in history, whatever it takes just to get through, which was very common with concentration camps, with battle
Certainly.
In World War II, and then also, as you remind us, behind the Iron Curtain.
Certainly. The characters are not all good or all bad. I mean, we are all human.
And yet we judge.
And yet we judge. And I think it's a very important point to remember that none of us know how we would react under such terrifying challenges. There are characters in the book who are perhaps more heroic than is common because it's a novel and I enjoy heroism and I enjoy people who will fight for love to the last. And there are characters who take the pragmatic way out. And we know from the example of history that there are many who were, had they not been unfortunate to be born into such terrible times, would never have done such terrible things. I mentioned in passing the dreadful case of the famous Jew capture, the blonde poison, the woman who was a Jewish, rich Jewish, you know, she had a wonderful life. She was eventually, obviously, in danger of being shipped off by the Gestapo and began to wander Berlin identifying underground Jews, submarine Jews, as a paid employee of the Gestapo. And I, obviously, I hope, and I really hope and believe I would never go that far. Hopefully, I would rather die than such a thing. But we don't know. And that woman faced a decision and took a terrible choice, which eventually led to her suicide, understandably.
And there were, in camps, there were
of course, there were capos. Of course there were.
The Jews who decided their path to survival was to cooperate with the Germans in order to get better food.
Go to any playground that still has a bully in it, and you'll see some people kowtowing to the bully in order to avoid being bullied. You know, and we all know, we are all human. And certainly my book, I hope, is a celebration of that humanity for all its foibles. We won't become the people we want to be unless we acknowledge our weaknesses and acknowledge the fact that we cannot be as good as we would hope to be. We can only hope to be the best we can be. I don't know if that convoluted sentence makes any sense.
It does if you were concentrating. That's not a problem.
Exactly.
Hey, Ben, but what's it like? I mean, this is a serious book. This is a novel, and it's about, you know, the sorts of things we're talking about, life and death and, you know, the whole damn lot. And yet you've made a living out of being funny.
I think there's a lot of comedy in this book. It certainly isn't a comedy, of course. It's a very sad book in many, many ways.
A rollicking slapstick, Dan.
A lot of readers have pointed out, of course, it's a family story. It's about two young lads growing up. They fall in love with the same girl. There's a lot of comedy to be had in that. And indeed, there is also dark comedy to be found in the unending banality of Nazi thinking. Until you truly research the level of two-dimensional banality that led their extraordinarily closed minds into this sort of dark institutionalized racism. It is actually funny to think of them measuring earlobes to accredit human value and yet not looking in their own mirror. To imagine Heinrich Himmler sitting down with his pen and writing what it is to be a valuable German who could join the SS. And did he never look in a mirror? Because he certainly did not live up to his own standards. And that's comedy, in a way. I don't have fun with it in a book, but I recognise that there is comedy in everything because the ability to laugh is clearly part of the glory of being human. And I never understood why the Greeks chose to divide those muses, comedy and tragedy, because to me, they go hand in hand. Just watch an episode of Fawlty Towers. You'll get the proof there.
I agree. I also feel like, and I don't know if this is a good comparison or a reasonable comparison, from doing, I used to be an actor a very, very long time ago, and then I've done stand-up for the last 4 or 5 years and then gone back to acting just occasionally. But my acting is so much better for having done the comedy, because when I'm in these tragic situations, I do automatically, you know, when I'm reading about a tragic situation, I automatically go for where the funny bits are, not to exploit them, but because there is so much nuance in life that there's never one thing or the other.
They're central to the human experience. And although I've been fortunate never to be in true fear or to live in any kind of real degradation, nonetheless, I imagine that
the TV show got axed.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Well, if that's the worst that's ever happened to me, that's proof enough. And I've had a few other career disasters, but I won't catalogue them. But let me say that I believe that there would be humour, of course, in every ghetto and in every camp, and probably better humour than you would find amongst the guards in the guard room. You know, comedy and wit and irony are a defence. There's no question.
It's a survival mechanism.
And it's central to being alive. And certainly there is humour in this book.
I had a John Cleese moment then. Don't talk about the war I did once, but I think I got away with it.
Oh, no. By all means, if you're talking about I had a live comedy show on Channel 9 last year and it got axed after three episodes. Happens all the time.
You've bounced back. You seem...
Oh, there's nothing to bounce from. I was 50 when that happened. I'd had 30 years in the business. You know? Look, obviously, it was horrid to work so hard on something, and particularly to see the youngsters that I'd searched really hard to find, new Australian performers. It was a shame it all went down. I thought Channel 9 were great to have a go. An hour of live sketch comedy, all live. The idea that on a week's not particularly good first episode, that would mean it was okay. It wasn't as bad as they said. It certainly wasn't as good as I'd hoped. Second week was great. All live comedy. But you think, well, if Australian art and popular art is to be judged in this kind of, you know, idea of thumb up, thumb down, certainly the young ones wouldn't have survived. I don't know anybody who liked the first time they watched the young ones. I've never met anybody who didn't first think, what's this? This is stupid. And then you slowly get into it. So I'm not saying whether it was any good or any bad, but it was my real sadness over the Channel 9 experience was how it sort of proved that really it's going to be very hard to develop new Australian work, because if we have this ratings gladiatorial nonsense. I went on radio, so mate, looks like your figures are down. The bookies are saying you're coming off. But I'm thinking, this isn't any way to judge.
A show called Women of Letters, and basically they invite people to write letters. And one of them was a letter of complaint. That was my topic. And I wrote an essay on a letter, basically how with any new adventure, not any, but a lot of new ventures on TV, we're standing there with the axe. We're waiting for it to be a failure. But more what actually surprised me about your show in particular is how well-versed we are as a nation to go, oh, this will be off in 2 episodes. And we've taught our audiences that if something doesn't work the first couple of times and the numbers go down, then it's off. We don't see a series out. And I don't understand that, because people still get paid. You know, people that are still under contract, they still get paid until the end of the contract, whether the show gets made or not. And it's just, I mean, I've been involved in a number of shows that have been axed as well.
Most of them are.
And it's I think it's fascinating that we've educated people.
Yeah, it's become a sort of game, and unfortunately, it's very, very against our own culture. I'm an Australian citizen. I've been Australian citizen for many years. The idea that local content should be judged in an American way, where this vast nation with vast resources that produces huge amounts of material. We produce tiny amounts of material.
Tiny.
I thought it was great that Channel 9 took a punt, but had they told me there was a risk that if it didn't instantly click, it would be off, I would have said, let's not do it, because it won't instantly click, because nothing that's any good ever does instantly click.
The first series of The Simpsons is pretty bad, most of it.
And so on and so on. Did they lie to you?
No, I thought, they didn't. I didn't. It never occurred
to
me.
Did they lead you to think you'd be given longer to prepare?
I just presumed. The question never came up. I mean, for me, the idea that you're attempting would, let me remind you, with an almost all new cast, to do an all live, entirely original Australian comedy show for an hour on a commercial network.
Set the bar as high as
you can. It didn't occur to me that the idea would be if you don't get a massive audience immediately who are tweeting that they love it, it'll be off. It would never have occurred to me, because I would have said, it won't work. I promise you it won't work, because if it's any good, it will not be instantly loved. That can't happen. It might be instantly loved by a few, but all the experience of my work, certainly Blackadder and the Young Ones, well, We Will Rock You is a very good example, takes time to bed in. I have no complaints. I've had wonderful chances, and I really thank Channel 9 for their chance, but if I'd known, I never would have tried it.
Ben Elton is here with a new novel. It's called Two Brothers. It's published by Bantam. It's in the shops now. It's a blockbuster of a book. It's 500 pages about two brothers who end up on opposite sides of the conflict in World War II. It's based loosely on his own family's experiences, but it is a novel. Ben Elton, our first guest, the ventriloquist David Strassman, joins us. Felicity Ward, my co-host.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Back in town is the ventriloquist David Strassman, who has 149 shows on at the MCG, and still there will be people who won't get to see
I don't
see
think
him.
My voice would last.
No, but it's just fantastic.
And he did bring the dunny.
Yeah, I brought the puppet into the radio studio.
Yeah.
Ventriloquism on the radio.
Yeah, it works really well.
It's idiotic.
It is idiotic. And thank you very much.
I can't
much.
See you behind that monitor there.
There's a screen in the way. Do you want me to move my chair?
No. You're not that good looking.
That serves me absolutely right. How many shows, David?
How many? We're doing 38 shows, I think. Yeah, it's pretty full on. We do two shows on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and it's back to back, and it's each show's 2 hours long, and I'm the only person on stage.
I'm on stage.
You're not real.
Piss off.
Hey, watch it, Chuck.
Ever done a cruise ship? Because Felicity's told us this morning that she's doing the cruise ship.
I refuse to do cruise ships, and I'll tell you why. It was the worst situation. I did two shows in
2 weeks.
You could
send him out on his own, yeah.
I float. But, no, in the middle of the night, at 2 in the morning, I'm taking a beautiful stroll in the tropics somewhere, and they're pouring their garbage over the side. And
no.
I watch hundreds and hundreds of these garbage bags filled with bottles and glasses.
No.
And in the moonlight, in the beautiful moonlight, there were these things bobbing on the ocean. And
oh,
in the wake
goodness.
Of the, this was 1992, I contacted Greenpeace.
Good on you.
Yeah, and I have a feeling there's worldwide legislation now, but no one knows what they do.
I will
waters.
Have my eyes peeled then the entire time.
And if there's anyone up at 2 in the morning, it'll be the comedians.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. When do you go to bed? Not at 11.
Well, it's nice to think ventriloquist eco-warrior. You
know?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I am. I mean, I'm very green, and I practice safe ventriloquism.
Oh, do you?
He's wearing a rubber glove. Yes.
Is he made of recycled materials?
I'm afraid not. I'm inside the glass.
you never tell a performer they're recycling their material.
Oh, nice. Oh, he's a boom man,
he's
isn't he?
Quick,
he is a boom.
Fane's on fire this morning.
And there's no team of writers behind the scenes either. But how that is, in fact, the issue for someone, as it was for Ben, coming up with live material for a new television show. How does David Strassman keep coming up with new ideas?
Well, I make sure I keep a 3-year gap between venues and cities, so it gives me a chance to not wear out my welcome. But I have a fantastic writer, Steve Altman. He's in Los Angeles. He's written my last 3 shows, and he'll do 80% of the show, and then I'll put in my own stuff. But it's a 3-month process. You write the show, and then they have to put all the production. I mean, I have robotics and visuals and full-on stage and sets and special effects and music. And so it really takes a hell of a lot of time and effort.
Do you work conceptually with Steve, did you say his name was?
Yeah.
So do you work on how you're going to do bigger and better and more? Because I think in our heads as an audience, we go ventriloquism, it's a man.
It's
and
math.
It has it's maths.
No, it's math.
It's all
it
a man.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, my problem is when you say the word ventriloquist, it's synonymous with mediocrity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've been swimming up that stream my entire career.
And so do you then get inspired by the idea that you're going to do something better, that you are going to...
Well, I've always had to reinvent myself.
Yeah.
In the late 80s, I did a routine where I put robotics in Chuck. He sacked me. I left the stage. And it was an amazing bit because no ventriloquist had ever done drama, really. And so he sat there and he went, "Is he gone?" And the audience is... They gasped because this is before Walking with Dinosaur, how to, documentaries. And
so you got his mouth. He had an
literally,
automated mouth.
Oh no, his whole head, and his eyes and his mouth moved robotically. And this is back in the late 80s. And then I decided, wow, I've entered the world of theater because my background, I studied acting, and so I put the elements of theater into my show rather than just standing on stage and telling
stupid jokes and
naff songs. Yeah. So my puppets all have character and conflict and all the same parameters you'd find in a stage play. So they have hopes, dreams.
What else? Fears, foibles, obsessions.
Eyebrows.
No.
Do they
His are painted on.
Do they ever have relationships with each other?
Inter-puppet-stitial sexual, no.
It's a slippery slope, Ben.
Oh, well, you want it to be slippery. Yeah, anyway, moving
Too
on.
Too soon. Not Come as, on. Not as, yeah. It's not midday
I'm
yet.
I'm not booming, am I? No. Just failing.
John, you say something. You're doing...
I got really...
Give me a wood joke.
I've got really bad wood. News. Because, David, I think I've been talking to you for about 15 or 16 years from as you come through the city.
Yeah.
And you're aging, but he's not.
Well, it's the picture of Chuck Wood. It's the picture of Dorian Gray. I actually age and he gets younger. Yeah.
But why does it? Could you age him? Could he be growing up as you are and as your audience is with you?
This is getting uncomfortable.
You're feeling uncomfortable, Chuck? Well, no, see, his character, he's the bad boy. And yeah.
Get stuff.
And so he fulfills our psychological want to challenge authority. And so when he tells a bloke in the front row to
get stuffed,
we find that funny because we want to do it.
Yeah, it's the rebel
and
in
so
you.
I don't, yeah, well, that's his character. I mean, I was going to say Elmo never grows up. So I'm not going to go there either.
Yeah. Not today,
I mean,
no.
Mickey Mouse is the same age. I mean, a character is a character when they're not real, I think.
Yeah, it's like Dennis the Menace or Bart Simpson. You know, you don't want him to grow up because he as you say, he fulfills that marvelous challenge to authority that we all enjoy and don't do ourselves. Yeah.
Right. I wanted to ask both of you this because I suffer from it. Are you ever afraid that this is the last joke, that you have just written the last joke? Because that is my relentless fear. I've written it down like, that's brilliant. I'm so excited. Mm. This is the best joke I've ever written. And then straight after that, the next thought is, that was the last one and you are finished.
I guess as a writer...
Both of you look very comfortable going, no.
No.
I think...
You have issues. Soliciting.
Oh, yeah. That's what drives me.
I think that writing jokes would be very hard. I don't feel I write jokes. I sort of like develop a comic idea around an idea.
Yeah, I agree.
And so to actually have to come up with the one-liners, you know, for instance, you know, Emo Phillips, you know, the kind of end, or Stephen Wright, you know, the brilliance of the, and I don't, forgive me, but I don't know your
Not
act,
many people so, do, Ben, don't
well,
feel
I'm
bad.
I'm booking a cruise, man. I'm getting my bottle, I'm taking my rubbish, actually, because the council won't pick it up.
They don't come regularly enough, you know, hard rubbish.
Just to get rid of it.
I'll sing her praises. Where did you come in the Edinburgh popularity listing?
Oh, I don't know. Somewhere in the top 10.
Well, top 10 out of 800 acts in Edinburgh.
I had heard you were very good. And
so there you go.
The answer is...
There's 5,000 shows in Edinburgh.
There you go.
At least 5,000.
Yeah. You were top 10.
But the comedy shows,
oh, right.
though.
Oh, yeah. She was definitely funnier than the student Macbeths, of which there are about 20.
Well, no, they were hilarious.
Oh,
they were
true.
Really funny.
Well, I think if you were attempting to write, like Stephen Wright does, brilliant bon mot, you might think, where will the next one come from? But I always think there'll always be ideas to develop. So, no, I don't have that fear.
Because conceptually, ideas-wise, I go, this is a funny idea. I know that there's something in here. But if I can't get to it, if I can't sort of... dust away the fossil.
But Felicity, as we travel through life, our perspectives change.
That's true. Thank
you. Yeah, it's true. And so you'll never write your last joke unless you give it up, right?
Yeah, well, hopefully.
We have faith. But we're going to
thanks,
watch.
Guys.
We have faith.
This has turned into a therapy session, and I'm not against that. Thank you very much.
I'm going to be shouting.
Do you hate your father?
No, my dad is dynamic. He is.
It was a joke, Felicity.
He takes up a lot of my material. He's one of... He I don't know if I should say this on air. I spoke to him recently, and he's just been to Indonesia. He goes, oh, he calls me Minnie. He goes, Minnie, God, I'm going to move there. It's such a beautiful place. There's beaches. There's no police.
No police.
Wasn't joking.
Why does he call you Minnie?
Because I didn't have a name in the hospital for the first three days, so everyone called me Minnie Mouse. So he just keeps calling me Minnie.
That works.
Yeah.
They called me Pine.
Back in the forest.
Back in
two
the
by four.
And Huon. And Huon.
Huon into humanity. Yes.
So how much robotics is there this time around? Because that very much became your hallmark the last few times.
Yeah, well, I've always used robotics in the end of my show for my finale, you know, the big whiz-bang bells and whistles. But I've developed a new technology. And there's one scene in the middle of my performance where I have a handheld wireless device and I operate Chuck live. and I'm doing his voices live and his movements live, but he sits 5 feet away from me on a couch. So
you're giving away the magic.
No, you can see it in my hand. It's not like I'm being a magician trying to hide it.
Right.
I mean, it's not. It's down at my side. It's not. I'm not holding it up for everybody to see. But I think we do this. Under you always wanted you to be. You're not the me I ever wanted to be. Sorry. Under you had to be because the you needed to be couldn't be the you wanted to be. So you created me to be the you could never be. And I do this little routine we're having an argument on who's controlling who, basically. The age-old ventriloquist.
It's interesting. I mean, very interesting areas to go in. Do you ever get lonely on the road?
Well, I cuddle with my dollies.
I mean, you know, you're a solo performer, and yet you populate your show with various
Nine separate entities.
Yeah, is it psychologically confusing? Well,
there is no dialogue in my head. And I think when I first started ventriloquism, I once went off to do a $50 gig somewhere. And I left Chuck behind. And as I'm driving back cursing I'm going to be late to go pick him up, I'm realizing, oh, my God, I'm not crazy. I literally forgot my puppet. And so he is my Stradivarius.
He's a prop.
But all journalists ask me, do you ever in the lift, say a disparaging remark to somebody and you just can't help yourself? Mm. And the answer is yes, no.
Do you enjoy the history of ventriloquy?
It's interesting. They say the oracles of Delphi were ventriloquists.
Yeah.
So but it's almost hearsay because the written record 4,000 years ago is not really to be believed. But
is it universal? A duo band, actually, the oracles.
I think they could have been.
Is it universal? Does it cross cultures? Did other civilizations, I know of English-speaking ventriloquists because I speak English, but do other cultures have ventriloquism?
I know that there's a very big famous Indian one, which I know nothing of, but apparently it has millions and millions of followers.
But is the whole idea of it, did it evolve in Chinese civilization? Did it evolve in Africa?
I think it evolved in Mesopotamia, I would guess. I mean, humans are fascinated with miniatures, and we love little things, train sets, army, girls' dolls. And for some reason, we love to anthropomorphize inanimate objects, especially...
behavior to them. Yeah,
first Neolithic carving is that of a fertility woman. It's, not a deer, it's a human. So... we delight in seeing things that are miniatures of us. And it's funny because I have...
Do Nordic cultures have ventriloquism?
I don't know if there's any Icelandic...
I think in the next Ridley Scott film, there's going to be a ventriloquist discovered on a planet on the edge of the universe, which will actually eat its way into someone's body. I think that's the source, yes.
Well, I don't know.
Cave paintings of hairy
people
men with their hands up.
Yeah.
Hands up.
With a bison on one of
your yourself, Elton.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering because it's such... I mean, we understand it, and of course in Australia, Ronnie Blaskett with Jerry G was such a part of growing up with television, just announced his retirement.
Yes, he did. He did it actually 10 years ago at 80, and then suddenly 10 years on, he couldn't stop.
Well, when he announced his retirement, he got so many people saying, can we have one last show, that he strung it out for 10
Jerry
years.
Jerry G's his puppet?
Yeah.
I wonder if when he announced his retirement, there wasn't a little hope that that might happen. It was certainly Sinatra's trick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To announce it in the hope.
Oh, no, don't.
In light of what's happening, I want to say that Jerry G touched me weird. Okay, come on, Chuck.
I mean, certainly, one of the biggest stars in Britain of the 1950s was Lord Charles, the Ray.
Well, prior to that, and it's funny when I do a lot of radio, obviously, and you'll get these radio stations, the top 40, they'll say, a ventriloquist on the radio. How does that work? And I have to remind them that in radio's beginning, the infancy, the first 10 years of radio in the 30s in the United States and England. Were led by ventriloquists.
Yeah, certainly in Britain.
It was Archie Andrews, Peter Brough and Archie Andrews was the English version of Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Absolutely. You would think it wouldn't
work. But why?
Well, I think it's because actually the relationship between the scamp, the challenger, the never-ending Bart Simpson naughty little boy and the sort of exasperated father figure is fascinating. The fact that you can see somebody not move their lips
but it has nothing
is
to do with that. It's character.
It's
character.
Yeah.
And a radio listener doesn't know if it's a ventriloquist or not. They just hear two separate entities.
It's the whole sound effects and radio plays, of course.
It's a one-person play.
And it's a different type of double act to, say, Morecambe and Wise on the radio, who were also
or the Goons.
Cochrane and 50 other. Well, that was a quad act, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was a radio play on the radio with sound effects and different voices and impersonations and blue bottle and all of that.
The thing is that a double act that comes from only one mind is a very interesting comic and dramatic dynamic.
It's actually sick.
Yeah, exactly.
So is this a one-man show or a two-man show?
Yeah. Well, this is one man doing a two-man show. Isn't it two men doing a one-man show? It's actually one man and one puppet doing a one-man show.
Do you get paid for both? That's the question.
I think it's one man doing an insane man show.
Has Chuck ever tried to be a ventriloquist? Because Chuck could have his...
There are ventriloquists that have a puppet on a puppet.
A puppet on a puppet is like Russian dolls, but
No, I've never really done that. Although in this particular show, there is a Chuck doppelganger. His evil twin is in this show with a shaved head and a Maori tats. And he tries to put me through the ventriloquist, makes me throw my voice and drink a glass of water and all that stuff.
Yeah. And Chuck, what do you think of your rough counterpart?
Well, it's in an alternate reality, so I'm not even existent when he's there.
You don't even know about it.
Exactly.
You're not threatened by it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, that's handy then, I suppose, because that avoids the confusion that otherwise would arise. None of which, of course, is happening here.
Confusion?
Now,
what about doing a month at the Athenaeum? That's fantastic. Congratulations. I mean,
well, I owe it to Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Well,
I really do.
We all miss that. There's very few places you can get out there and plug your stuff and show yourself.
But a live show on television that's variety, it's just not non-existent.
Well, I had a bash. It's true. I mean, Hey Hey for all, you know, everyone had a different opinion, but my goodness, we miss it.
Telling Felicity, I went to some ranch out in the middle of the Simpson Desert. And the guy recognized me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, my God, I really reached all of Australia.
Hey Hey reached everyone.
Everyone.
It
did
indeed.
Everyone.
And you've been at the Children's Hospital, I understand, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I'm going today, actually.
What's a new generation make of, if they haven't already been familiar with your routine?
Well, I don't bring Chuck for obvious reasons. Yeah, we...
My the competition? Too many kids?
No, I do play therapy, so I don't want to make the kids sicker. So, no, I bring Teddy Bear, who is the, you know, lovable, cute, innocuous Teddy Bear. And so I've visited most children's hospitals in Australia, and I walk bed to bed, and I'm able to provide, alleviate the hospital situation for a brief moment. And it's very therapeutic when you get a kid who hasn't smiled for weeks and weeks.
I reckon some of the teenagers would love
Chuck. I actually don't do teenagers. They find a grown man walking in their room with a doll a bit beneath them. So,
do you know why? Because they find everything beneath them because they're teenagers.
Exactly. So I stick with the younger children who really need cheering
up. It's true. Who still have a sense of magic. You see, my kids have just become teenagers, and you just see the change.
Oh, my sympathies.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is no Father Christmas?
Oh, yeah. Easter Bunny's real. Santa's real.
Absolutely.
You've got plenty of time, Chuck, though.
And all parents are embarrassing. Lisa Marie Presley is apparently lives in Britain and works in a chip shop in a little village. It's extraordinary. But I'd love to one day meet her and say, did you think your dad was really daggy and uncool? the daughter of the king of rock and roll. Because all I can say is, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, your
dad,
children don't
think you're cool.
Dad,
why are you wearing a onesie?
Cool.
That's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Why don't you eat like normal people?
Exactly. It's a nightmare.
I apologized to my parents when I realized what I'd put them through. I went around there unannounced one day.
Yeah.
Knocked on the door and said, hi, I'm just here to say sorry.
Aww. Good son.
Well, you weren't thinking about the will by any chance.
No, I
you?
Recommend it. It was very therapeutic and I recommend it to everybody.
Unlikely.
Can
David Stressman nearly sold out.
By the way, that show is completely family clean.
Wow.
Yeah.
For 2 hours.
Chuck, you're not
No,
going?
No, it's actually an hour show.
All right, yeah.
But see, if I cut out, you know, an hour of profanity, then...
Then it's a quick show.
So you're leaving Chuck out of that one entirely?
No, he'll be in the show. You know, I used to, you know,
Chuck, you can't do a clean family show.
Dude.
You couldn't.
Back in the 90s, I used to do 15 children's shows in the afternoon, throughout the week, and then I'd do adult shows at night. So I can certainly do a kid show.
Well, Ronnie Blaskett and Jerry G used to work blue for sportsman's nights, as he called them too. So there's a long tradition of that as well. David Strassman back in town. Ben Elton's book, Two Brothers and Felicity Ward, off on a cruise. Thank you all for coming on 774 ABC Melbourne.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.